All right, here we go.
Broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University, this is WSDL Ocean City 90.7 FM. It's time now for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
This past few weeks has been eventful, to say the least. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. For the U.S. Supreme Court, the justice struck down the Defense of Marriage Act while dismissing the plaintiffs who supported California's Proposition 8 that banned same-sex marriage. The High Court also struck down the 1965 Voting Rights Act. And then on Capitol Hill, the Republican-controlled House of Representatives failed to pass the Farm Bill while the Democrats in the Senate got some bipartisan support for their immigration reform bill. And in our studio is Professor Michael Laughlin. He's with Salisbury University. And welcome to the program, Michael. So let's start with the Supreme Court. And it seems as if we almost have two contradictory decisions. On the one hand, we have certainly a landmark decision when it comes to gay rights. We've now moved ahead in terms of overturning DOMA and gutting, as it were, at least for the moment, Proposition 8. On the other hand, the High Court then moved against the 1965 Voting Rights Act, basically gutting that operative portion. What do you make of what the court is doing?
Well, I think one dimension that ties these two decisions together is that in both cases, it really empowers the states. In both cases, the states really, the issue is, in effect, placed back in the role of the states. The striking down the Voting Rights Act, or a major dimension of it, really said, okay, all the states now are going to be equally judged, and therefore, in effect, it empowers those states that wish to implement and pass and implement more restrictive voting practices, like showing photo IDs and special IDs and so on, can now proceed with that without having to go through a federal checking of what they're doing. So now that doesn't mean these cases can't be litigated, but it is going to require now state by state litigation and at the state level. So in effect, that decision has given power back to the states. And in the DOMA case, no question, I think in this case, it's a brighter future in terms of equality of rights. But again, it places that issue back into the states because only X number of states, I think it's what, 13 states really have declared gay rights, the marriage rights to gay couples. Other states have not. And therefore, the battle will have to now, again, take place at the state level.
What do you think it says, the Voting Rights Act, what do you think it says about where conservatives are in terms of undercutting particularly the political power that seems to be there as we see the changing demographics, both for Hispanics and for African Americans, but particularly Hispanics in terms of just the sheer politics of it? Because it seems to me that what's been called the generation of ascendancy here in the United States, that this seems to allow, at least in southern states anyway, certainly from trying to hold that back. And in the case, for instance, even a state like Pennsylvania, where you have voter ID laws, which they try to impose, again, almost openly saying, we're going to try to win this this particular state for Mitt Romney. I mean, is there politics you see involved here in that sense in terms of the Voting Rights Act?
Unquestionably, and I think the best way to understand this is to focus on the conservative caucus in the House of Representatives. Many of those districts have been gerrymandered in such a way that they are pretty safe in their districts, but only so long as they can continue to suppress particular ethnic minorities, and in particular the Latino community, which is the fastest growing minority, to the extent that wave of potential voters can be minimized in some fashion, they can then, therefore, the House members, conservative Republican House members, can retain their power position within their own districts and therefore continue to have perhaps majority status in the House of Representatives. How long that can be sustained is another kind, is another question. Again, most analysts have argued that what's happening now is that we have, in effect, two kind of election cycles going on. The presidential election cycle on the one hand, which is a national cycle in an important sense, and then the off-presidential elections coming 2 years afterwards, and where we see a lower turnout, and therefore lower turnout continues in the next couple cycles, probably will allow the potential for the conservatives to maintain, conservative Republicans to maintain power in the House of Representatives. But the presidential cycle, the Latino vote and African-American vote are going to be sufficiently powerful on a national level to give potential Democrats a continued reign at the presidential level. A decade out, this kind of strategy on the Republican side is unlikely to be able to be sustained, even with the kind of empowerment that this particular Supreme Court has given them at this point, because again, these, you know, unless you're able to somehow prevent people from having children, particularly in the Latino community, that's the color of the United States, and the color of the voting population is going to shift to the minority being in the majority.
Now, speaking of House Republicans, certainly in the House, they couldn't get their act together in terms of the Farm Bill. Farm Bill, they kind of moved forward a little. They had Democratic votes. It looks as if the House Republicans went too far with a couple of measures to attach to food stamps. Democrats pulled it, and Republicans were not able to get a majority of their own people to approve it, which, by the way, might note is unlike, for instance, the tenure of the Democrats under House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. She got her votes no matter what. What's going on with the Republican Party in the House? I mean, is this the tail wagging the dog?
I think it continues to reveal the inability of the leadership to lead. That I think there's a sufficiently powerful rump group, essentially, of conservatives in the Republican caucus that can just stick it in the eye, not only of the Democrats, but of their own leadership. Because this was in particular an embarrassing moment, because the Farm Bill has always been, has had bipartisan support. I mean, time after time after time. I mean, whatever its flaws, and there could be a lot of them, it was able to be passed because it served a sufficient number of clientele groups and constituencies that both sides were able to agree. At some point, the leadership was going to have to try to cobble together some kind of bipartisan support. But it remains to be seen how that is going to be done in the near-term future.
Because my understanding is that they had the 40 votes out of the Democratic caucus.
Yes. Oh, yes.
And it just, they just took a bridge too far and with these amendments.
It was a poison pill, essentially, from the conservative side, I think. They understood that, and they were willing to do that. Again, what we find again and again, talk about bomb throwers. These guys make Newt Gingrich look like a piper.
Now, turning to the Senate side, the Democrats in the Senate side, who they still control that particular House, they were able to cobble together an immigration bill, and they were actually able to get some Republicans so that they heading towards that 70 vote mark. What do you make of the dynamic there?
It is, it seems, a similar uphill battle for immigration reform. Because once again, I think when you look at the conservatives in the House of Representatives, that rump group again, they are, at least for the short term, in safe enough districts that there's little incentive for them to buy into immigration reform, any kind of immigration reform that gives some kind of relief to undocumented folks in the United States presently. And that's it seems to me, continues to be a stumbling block for them. So that any plan that will, in effect, be similar to the Senate passed plan or similar to what Democrats might support in the House is anathema to many of these folks. And they can continue to resist that without endangering their own reelection and they don't have to violate their own ideologically driven perspective, which essentially I think is a very simple one, and that is they say these folks have broken the law, therefore they must be punished or must be deported from the country. So any kind of relief seems against their principles.
We've been speaking with Professor Michael Laughlin. He's a professor at Salisbury University. It does sound as if the Republicans may be have fallen into a trap, but we will see. We will talk about this more. You're listening to Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush, and we'll be back in a moment. Maryland is reaching out to the public to get the word out about the upcoming implementation of the Affordable Care Act, as well as the new health insurance exchanges being set up. So we turn to Maryland Controller Peter Fanchot, and welcome to the program.
Don, it's great to be with you, and let me just start by presenting you with something that, I feel very strongly about, recognizing people that have done really good things for Maryland, and you've had a great career in public radio. I know you started on the West Coast, and now you're here, and you've got all sorts of awards for your reporting, et cetera. I recently had minted, at my expense, these are not paid for by the taxpayers, comptroller medals. Says Treasury Department, Comptroller's Office. It's got my name on the back. It's a really nice, I got these things because Louis Goldstein was handing out gold coins all over the place.
Yes.
So, and people kept asking me for these things, and I didn't want to, get too close to Louis because he was such an icon. But I did make this nice medal up, and I give it to certain select people around the state. And based on your wonderful career and the great accomplishments and the contributions you make to public radio, I'd like to present you.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Controller's Medal. It's not worth anything.
I can't take it down the slot machine, right?
Help you with your taxes if you get
there
a problem.
You go.
Put that down on the table. But it's heartfelt.
I appreciate that.
The people of this region benefit from you, and I'm really delighted to present that to you.
Okay. No, very nice. Thank you very much. Yes. Well, let's get to the issue at hand, healthcare exchanges.
Yes.
Now there's some outreach being done. Tell me, first of all, a little bit about that in terms of trying to educate people about healthcare and the exchanges and what they should be doing and what they should know.
Well, that is ongoing, that the administration, the O'Malley administration, is promoting that. And obviously healthcare is a wonderful thing. We want to have access to health care for everybody, but we forgot to figure out how to pay for it. So as a result, the health exchanges are being promoted and introduced, and I'm very appreciative of that. Obviously, we all want to have health care available to everybody, but the question of how we pay for it is very much up in the air. And I, as comptroller, will not be involved in the implementation of the Affordable Health Care Act, but I certainly am going to be monitoring the cost, because what we've done is taken a very broken health care system and essentially let everybody in, much of it at government expense. And at the problem is, at the end of the day, it's still the same broken system where people are going to very expensive acute care hospitals in order to get just basic clinical care. So I will be monitoring that very closely, because the question of whether we're going to be able to pay for this wonderful program is very much up in the air.
Well, what do you make of the of this idea that I know that the number of healthcare providers or the insurers, CareFirst, for example, they're all talking about major increases, something 25% in some cases. I think CareFirst actually indicated that, that some people could actually be hit with an increase in their premium of 100% to 150%. Now, they emphasize that this is only a small group of people, probably younger. But what about that side of it? Because I know that Attorney General Doug Gansler, said, hey, we want a cap. What do you
think? Well, that may be. But look, and I'm not a big supporter of healthcare insurance companies. My goodness, they drive me crazy just like everybody else. But you take the system and you add 40 million people to it nationally. You say that pre-existing conditions cannot be disqualification, that we're going to now cover kids up to age 26, these are all wonderful benefits. Who's going to pay for it? Is it just, we're going to print some more money in the basement of some place in Washington? I mean, it really addresses the health care situation, how to pay for it from the government side, really brings up this whole issue of what we're doing economically in the country. I mean, pretty soon the party's going to be over, Don. I mean, we have had an unbelievable experience in the last 5 years with the stimulus money that's been put into the economy, and interest rates are very low. My home mortgage in Tacoma Park is under 4%. I can remember when I bought my first house, I had a Veterans Administration loan because I've been in the Army. I thought I'd died and gone to heaven because I had a 13% mortgage, and it was better than my neighbors. But this, you know, the party's over as far as low interest rates, and we've simply got to figure out how to pay for all of the things that we value so highly. So healthcare is an uncertainty right now, and I'm urging fiscal discipline on my fellow Democrats, not because I don't like government programs. I do like government programs, but we've got to be able to afford them. If we can't pay for them, then the entire program is jeopardized.
Okay. Well, let me ask you this, because we all
didn't mean to go on and on, but you know, this is an incredibly important issue, and all your listeners out there, I'm urging everybody to be very, very careful. This recovery that we read about is so tenuous, and if interest rates start going up, I mean, imagine,
right?
I mean, imagine you have a home right now, and you've got one of these variable rate mortgages. I'm not saying that interest rates are going to double and triple and get back to what they were when I 1980 when I got that 13% loan. But if they go up sharply, people could be at risk of losing their homes, et cetera, with these mortgages that are adjusted.
What does that mean for the state? I mean, obviously you have bonds that you for capital expenditures and so on, but it's a pay-as-you-go kind of thing for the state itself, though. I mean,
the state
for
of Maryland,
the operation, so that it shouldn't affect that, right?
Trust me, Don, the state of Maryland has lots of money, plenty of money to pay all its bills. That is not the problem.
Yeah.
It's people here, particularly on the shore, where they don't have the income. They either don't have jobs or their jobs are not adequately paying them properly because the wage growth is so abysmal. And yes, there's a little bit of a increase in the housing market, but the savings rate right now is 2.3% for people in Maryland, and that's way too low. And we're essentially, what little consumer spending we see in the state is coming out of people's savings. So we've got a tenuous recovery. The state is fine. Even the public county budgets are probably okay because tax revenues have been increased significantly over the last 5 years. So they will have adequate money. It's you and other citizens who are suffering from this sluggish economic recovery that I'm particularly concerned about.
Do you see a double dip in recession?
I don't know what is going to happen because this is, predicting the economy is like predicting the weather.
I mean, we saw, for instance, that the market, that as soon as the Fed chairs had talked about the idea that, well, they might stop buying bonds, the market, dropped some 300 or 400 points. Very sensitive to this, to anything. I mean, and they just breathed it. They didn't even say they were going to do it.
Yeah, no. Remember, a week ago, all the experts were saying, gee, the economy's going gangbusters. Look at the housing recovery and look at the stock market. Well, they don't say look at the stock market anymore. It's just tenuous. That's the point that I'm making. And people need to protect themselves. Personally, make sure their exposure to adjustable rate mortgages is not going to put them in a situation where if for some reason interest rates go up dramatically, they get caught. And, I'm particularly concerned about seniors that may have gotten into those mortgages because they're very attractive.
Right.
You don't pay very much, but you have quite a bit of exposure. And then on the overall fiscal issue, I'm just reminding folks that the public budgets are separate from the private economy. The private economy is still very, very difficult. We have a big employment problem. I mentioned the wage growth. We're paying people less than we paid them 5 or 6 years ago. That means they have less money in their pocket. When they have less money in their pocket, they don't go and visit restaurants, et cetera. It's pretty basic stuff. But I would urge people to put a raincoat on, take an umbrella. All this sunshine that people talk about is it's just not responsible. The responsible thing right now is to be extremely cautious.
Well, if you were to deal with particularly the unemployment issue, which is probably the most serious, what would you do? I mean, or is it just you have to ride this out? I mean, as a government, the government have to ride it out? Is there something the government can do, the state or federal level?
I mean, first of all, there are international things that play here, the global economy and the technology. Everything's changing as far as employment in the economy. But in Maryland, we have worst business reputations of any state in the country. Why is that? That's because we're so focused on these great programs that we all support, education, health care, and protecting the environment. We spend a lot of time on that. And that's okay. I mean, I'm all in support of that. But we forget about the private sector, and we just take them for granted. They're kind of a second priority here in Maryland. And as a result, the private sector is much more interested in states like Virginia, where there's a much better atmosphere as far as regulations and taxes. And in Maryland, I think the problem is that we just haven't paid attention to the private sector, and we just say, hey, you guys are like an ATM machine for us to get money for all these programs we want to promote. Well, be careful because, as I said, the wonderful programs we care about can be jeopardized if business heads elsewhere. So if our leaders relentlessly focused on the assets of the state, the business assets, I think we would have a booming economy and we would not need 300,000 jobs. But they haven't, we haven't, and as a result, we have this situation where where we need to make some adjustments.
I want to turn to what might be an I told you so moment, which is that the state of Delaware is now talking about bailing out its casinos at $8 million. I do understand, by the way, that Maryland Live, the new casino, it is raking in some dollars. One of the stats was that apparently Delaware's slots revenue is down by 5.5%. I think ours is in Maryland's actually up. What do we make of I know that you were not really a big fan of the gambling business. And what do you make of this shift? Because one of the things I saw, particularly over the weekend, was this idea that nationally we've kind of topped out in terms of gambling dollars. They've actually been declining, and now all these states, whether it's us or it's Delaware or it's Pennsylvania, all sort of now trying to draw from the same declining pot.
No, it's very unfortunate. It's a race to the bottom, and we're competing with Delaware and Pennsylvania for gambling addicts to come and give us their money so that we can, in theory, do good things with it. No, it's going to be something that we regret in Maryland. Delaware, obviously, is now seeing their revenues collapse because of the competition from Maryland. And we're going to have three of the four largest casinos in the country once they all get built over in the Prince George's Live Casino and the one up in Baltimore. Well, those will get up and running. And sure enough, a couple of years from now, Virginia will open a big casino. And our casino revenues that we get dependent on will be drained off by some competitive neighbor of ours. And it's another black mark on Maryland that we have gone this route. And it's a really lousy way to generate economic development, and it's a very uncertain, as Delaware is learning right now, a very uncertain source of revenue for important programs. Hey, let's just get back to the old-fashioned stuff of having economic activity from things that are good for people and generate good things. These casinos, the money that Maryland gets from them, are going to come from people that are just desperately addicted to gambling. That's where the profits come from. It doesn't come from us going and entertaining ourselves by playing the slots for a couple of days. It comes from people that go 6-7 days a week. They have a mental illness, gambling addiction, and the state is right now just going to participate with these Las Vegas companies in taking advantage of them. But, hey, I fought that battle. I lost it.
You lost, right. And now you can say you told yourself, right.
Well, I'm not going to say I told you so. I'm just going to say that what Delaware is experiencing right now, and the call to subsidize with taxpayers these for-profit casinos in Delaware, we're going to see the same thing in a few years in Maryland. And that's just sad.
Politics. What's your political future?
I'm running for re-election comptroller. And
that's what I hear.
Asking, and a lot of people were disappointed that I decided not to run for governor, but I love, I've got a great position, and I can do a lot of good. I'm particularly focused like a laser on these economic issues because they're not partisan, they're not Democrat or Republican. They're really just what's common sense, what works, and, shouldn't we be cautious with our budgets and our private sector economy, because that's what is real for people. We talk about the public budgets. Great. I'm all for good solvent public budgets. But I'm really worried about the real Maryland economy. And I often say to people, I don't have to be comptroller. I mean, you can defeat me if you want, but I'm going to spend the next 2 years focus as fervently as I can be on making sure that the private sector knows that we need them in Maryland. We need them to be successful. We need to do what we can as public officials to create a good business reputation and a good environment in the state for creating jobs, because right now we don't have it, and we need to make those adjustments. And what's going on at the national level is really troubling, Don. It's just everything is hopelessly politicized. And all these economic debates that we see, it's all become, are you conservative, are you liberal, are you Republican, are you Democrat? Hey, forget that, guys. Roll up your sleeves. Fix the do what's necessary in order to promote a sound economy. After that, we can deal with all the social issues. But right now, the economy is front and center.
By the way, you favor anybody in the gubernatorial race? Or you?
No, I saw Anthony Brown last night at the MML conference. And, he's an old friend of mine, and Gansler's a friend of mine, and I told the group I was speaking to, because they asked that, I said, I'm going to be like Switzerland. I'm a safe haven. I'm neutral. And Anthony yelled out something about he was related to someone who came from Switzerland. I said, no, that doesn't count, Lieutenant Governor. I'm going to be just trying to be a help to everybody. It's a job that I don't think the public understands. It's not as great a job as you think, because there's so much stress and there's so many things being pushed and pulled. So my hat's off to all the folks, Republican and Democrat, who are going to run for that job. And where I can help on the get some fiscal discipline and fiscal accountability, try to tell the Democrats that, it's not how much money you spend. That's not the measure of success. It's how good the program is. And say to the Republicans, hey, can't we get off the ideology a little bit and link up and work for the betterment of the state? So that's kind of me. And, Don, I'm delighted to be here with you. And congratulations again on getting the comptroller's medal.
I really appreciate it. This is very nice. I will treasure it.
Well, it's well-deserved. And And I'm giving a bunch of them out, and I'm trying not to be like Louis Goldstein because he was such a legend. But it's just a small thing from the people of the state of Maryland saying thank you.
Well, thank you. We've been speaking with Maryland Comptroller Peter Franchot, and we'll be back after a moment. We've been speaking with Maryland Comptroller Peter Franchot. This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush, and thanks for listening.
Delmarva Today is a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Don Rush is the host. Chris Rank is the executive producer and audio engineer. You can listen to this program again on our website, delmarvapublicradio.net. You can also view our program on PAC-14 television and on demand. Visit PAC14.org for full details and schedules.